So I had a plan for this part of our time together, but as with all plans, it went the way of all conditioned things. When I sat down to a little while ago to give some thought to what might be appropriate for us to explore, the plan dissolved in front of my eyes, and it became apparent that it would be much more appropriate just to explore what is this bodhisattvic aspiration we've committed ourselves to. And it's very interesting, you know, this bodhisattvic aspiration is probably the highest ideal that the human mind has ever conceived of. You think about it. Can you conceive of a higher ideal than dedicating one's life and possibly all lives to the highest good and highest awakening of all conscious life? If you can, please let me know. I'd be very interested. So this is an extraordinary ideal, literally the highest ideal the human mind has ever conceived of. And yet it's very important to know that ideals can be used skillfully or unskillfully. Used skillfully, they are wonderful guides for life and well-being and happiness for ourselves and others. Used unskillfully, they become what the yogic tradition calls golden chains. There are iron chains and there are golden chains. Iron chains are the chains to the traps of sensuality, money, power, status, sex, etc. But golden chains are very interesting. They are the chains that arise when we become attached to our ideals and use them in an unskillful way. So it's very useful to know, since we're committing ourselves to the highest ideals in this practice and in this ceremony and henceforth in our lives, to know the difference between unskillful and skillful use of ideals. The unskillful use of an ideal sets it up as a specific goal, becomes attached to it, and then beats ourselves up because we're not matching up to the ideal. Okay. Anyone not done that? But a skillful use of ideal uses it more as a pointer or an arrow. That's the direction I want to go. That's what I want my life to be like. Those are the qualities I want to cultivate. A skillful use of an ideal is like a pointer or a direction that brings us back to what truly matters. So it's a very, very crucial distinction, because unskillful use of ideals leads to suffering, plain and simple. Skillful use leads to the virtues and to the goods. So what is this bodhisattvic ideal? Well, I like to reframe it for myself, and I don't know the ins and outs of the translation, but I reframe it for myself as a bodhisattvic aspiration. Because in my mind, a vow is to do a particular thing, and I have no idea how the future is going to turn out. In fact, part of spiritual practice is setting for oneself one's ideals and then simultaneously and working as hard and one skillfully as one possibly can to realize them, while simultaneously recognizing that the outcome is not up to us and that our task is to this delicate knife edge balance of working towards our ideals, cultivating those qualities in ourselves, and relinquishing attachment to how things turn out. Okay. So an aspiration is a concept which lends itself to skillful use of an ideal and specifically the bodhisattvic ideal. So And you can feel the difference. It takes off an enormous weight. It's like, this being is going to liberate all beings. Well, maybe, but instant feedback. So, first shift I make for myself is to think of this as an aspiration, okay, and to check whether I'm using it skillfully, whether I'm becoming attached to being pure and holy and all those things, all of which I aspire to, but all of which I fall short of. This is the human realm, and the human realm is a mix. You know, where there's samsara, there's suffering. You know, samsara sucks. So that's the first shift I make. Second thing that I think is it becomes easier to hold the bodhisattvic aspiration skillfully if we know a little more about it. And the first thing to know is that we initially think of the bodhisattvic aspiration and quality as something we cultivate. And it is. We do the practices, the Brahmaviharas, the awareness, etc., etc., and we cultivate the requisite qualities. And we refine our motivation and purify it, and etc. And as we do so, we gradually come to a wonderful recognition. And the recognition is that this aspiration, this ideal to serve and awaken others, is actually what we always already most deeply want. When we clear away the garbage overlying our true nature, overlying our deepest motivation, we find that this is actually what we always already in this moment most want in our deepest heart. And we recognize that the bodhisattvic practices are not just a cultivation, they're an unveiling and a recognition. And that shifts it enormously. And this recognition that the bodhisattvic aspiration is what we truly deeply want to do with our lives reframes our whole understanding of several things. It reframes our understanding of our motivation. We come to recognize that our fundamental motivation is benign and benevolent. We all have a belief that we have all these destructive, painful motives, and at a superficial level we do. But below those, we recognize that our motivation is fundamentally benevolent and benign, and those malevolent, unskillful motives are an expression of our confusion and lack of understanding of who and what we really are. Second, of course, this gives us a whole different appreciation of the bodhisattvic aspiration. And third, it gives us a very different understanding of our identity, of who and what we really are. Because all of us, as long as we are identified with a separate self sense, have an ambivalent self-image, seeing ourselves as partly good, partly bad, partly benevolent, partly harmful, partly trustworthy, partly untrustworthy. And if you look deeply enough, it seems that every one of us harbors in some form the belief that in some way we are fundamentally flawed. I call this the fundamental flaw fallacy. And as far as I can understand, and here we're getting, all I can give you is my understanding. this fundamental flaw fallacy, this assumption that at some level we are, in some way we are fundamentally flawed, is inherent in the separate self sense. The ego, or the sense of being a separate self, is an illusory mental construction overlaid on top of our fundamental unity and interconnection. The unexamined self-sense that 99.9% of the planet assumes us to be, this egoic mind, is a mental construction and an illusory one at that, or a false self. And this the egoic mind at some level seems to recognize the illusory false nature of this identity, and experiences this. The ego experiences itself as having a fundamental sense of deficiency, insecurity, and being under threat. And it therefore attempts, as a fundamental project, to compensate for this inherent sense of deficiency or lack by acquiring things and people that suggest it's real and important. Okay. And you only have to take a look out at the world to see how universal that is and how destructive it is. And it also defends against an inherent sense of threat by defensiveness and attack. And here's where it gets really interesting. By fostering a negative self-image so you avoid looking at it. Very interesting. The ego, the separate self-sense, really doesn't want to be looked at closely. And practically all of us who sat down in meditation have come to recognize that. But we run up against all these resistances and barriers and fears of, oh my God, what will I find if I look at myself closely? And so 99.9% of the people on the planet never really do. And their self-sense is just an unexamined presupposition. Most people go a lifetime without ever seriously investigating their sense of self and their minds, which they assume to be negative. And one of the greatest tragedies of all is that most of the planet is running around fearful of finding out, fearful of their own minds, and engaged in a never-ending attempt to distract themselves from their own experience. The philosopher Kierkegaard called it tranquilization by the trivial. And Western culture and media have mastered this like no other culture in history. And here's where it gets really interesting. It seems like there's a certain validity to this. Because, as you know, all of you have looked very carefully and very deeply. And as you know, when you first turn attention inward, what you find is all this negativity, all these fears and phobias you haven't wanted to face, all these memories you buried, all these recollections of the people you hurt, of the traumas you suffered, that you've been desperately spending a life trying to avoid experiencing fully. Well, there are two things you need to know about the way the mind works. One is, what you're unwilling to experience runs your life. And two, whatever you're unwilling to experience sticks around in the mind until you are willing to experience it. Bad recipe. And so when you first look you see all this negativity, and most people immediately assume, my God, that's all that is, that's there, enough. Back to the television, back to food, money, power, sex, anything. But our mind is kind of like a rusty faucet that's been turned off for years. Really, it's been clamped down for years. What happens when you open the faucet for the first time is all this rust and gunk comes out, and you think, oh, that's all that is, blah, turned off. But if you let it keep running, the water gradually becomes clear and pure. Same with our minds. We discover that what we thought to be who and what we are and to be the sum total of our nature is actually just the surface layer waiting to be experienced so it can be released. When we turn the healing light of awareness on it, then it can untangle and unfold and release and transform ultimately into the five wisdoms. So, how's this fit with the bodhisattvic aspiration? Well, wonderfully. Because the bodhisattvic aspiration is in many ways the exact opposite of the egoic aspiration. And it undoes or unravels egoic motivation and thereby dissolves it. As we turn within, we recognize our interconnection. We see others are just as important as we are. The bodhisattvic aspiration aims primarily at the well-being of others, and the great recognition is the well-being of others and our own is intimately linked. The bodhisattvic aspiration aims for the highest good for ourselves and everyone, not for defensiveness and attack. It aims for awakening. In fact, in the classic description of the moment which the bodhisattvic aspiration dawns, bodhicittapada, there are three realizations. There's the realization, oh my God, I've been asleep in dreams, lost into dreams my entire life. And oh my, everyone else is lost in the same dream. What else could I possibly want except to awaken us all? So the bodhisattvic aspiration sees our situation and sees what that and wants to get us out of it, to awaken us. And the bodhisattvic aspiration recognizes service of others not as a sacrifice, but as enlightened self-interest. It recognizes that service is joy. There's an Indian saying, when I don't know who I am, I serve you. When I do know who I am you. Or as Tagore, the great Nobel Prize winning Indian poet, put it, I slept and dreamt that life was service. I awoke and found that service is joy. So as you continue, when you take this bodhisattvic aspiration and continue doing these supportive practices, such as the Brahmaviharas, such as generosity, you gradually recognize 10 things. First, you recognize that you really want to help, to heal, to serve, and awaken. This is something you really want. And you recognize that the bodhisattvic aspiration and activity are actually perfectly aligned with and natural expressions of our true nature. They're not something foreign to us. They are perfectly aligned with who and what we want and are. Fourth, bodhisattvic activity becomes and is recognized as a natural, joyful, spontaneous expression of our true nature. Fifth, gradually you come to recognize that your true nature, who and what we really are, is primordially pure, joyful, and benevolent. Just the opposite of the ego. And your true nature is not only more and more wonderful than you thought, it's actually more and more wonderful than you can think. And sixth, you recognize that others share this same identity. Although as yet unrecognized by them. And so they suffer. And seven, recognizing who you really are and who others really are, what could you possibly want more than to awaken them to their true nature and relieve their suffering, and in the process relieve yours and awaken more fully to your identity? And having recognized all this, as a further eighth step, you recognize this, you look for more and more opportunities to serve and to express your true nature and to express your bodhisattvic aspiration, not out of sacrifice, but out of deep desire. And then gradually you recognize that every act and every activity can be an expression of your bodhisattvic activity and a means to strengthen it. Because the meaning and significance of any activity depends on the intention you give it. And we can intend to use any activity for our awakening, our learning and growth, and thereby to better equip ourselves to serve and awaken others. And tenth and finally, you finally recognize that every activity can serve to express and deepen your bodhisattvic aspiration and to awaken yourself and all others. All life is now your bodhisattvic playground. What a wonderful gift we've been given with this ceremony and these commitments. What a wonderful gift you've given yourselves. So, would anyone like to add anything or comment or question?
Roger. So I just wanted to be clear, as I understood it in your saying, is the fundamental flaw, fallacy, is that we are a separate self.
The fundamental flaw, fallacy, comes with having a separate self or being identified with a separate self. And the separate self sense inherent is in that seems to be an assumption. There's something wrong with me. It's kind of a deep feeling out of which a lot of neuroses and painful and destructive behavior comes. So does that make sense?
It does. It does. And then just a clarification in terms of the 10 realizations. I'm not sure if I got 1, 2, 3, 4 on went pretty well for me, but.
Yes, let's see. What were they? We'll make up another 10. Let's see. And these are seem to be in an order, but of course they support each other. You gradually recognize first that you really want to help and heal and serve and awaken. And the second, that this is the most meaningful and joyful thing you can do. You increasingly recognize service. Awakening service is such a joy and such a privilege. And third, you recognize that bodhisattvic activity is actually perfectly aligned with and a natural expression of our true nature. Anyone miss any others? Nicole, was it? Yeah.
Thank you. So I think intuitively at some point, I sort of started understanding karma years ago and have spent a lot of time focusing on sort of bodhicitta activity towards others. And now through a lot of these talks and coming to these retreats have sort of use that as an awakened self-enlightenment activity, you know, being aware of that and using that, and it's been profound. It's been life-changing. What I'm still having difficulty with, though, is I feel like I can pause and reflect and be mindful of my activities and actions and words with others. But towards myself, it's, you know, and I realize this is just the path and eventually that will shift, so I'm patient with that, but I'm also very impatient with that. I think that the mindfulness of it has shifted, but I don't feel like I've really let up on it. Instead, I'm sort of doing what, as I was entering the room, you were saying, sort of holding this as an aspiration and getting frustrated that I'm not there yet, that I'm still have so much self-doubt. Mm-hmm. So I realize that this is another side of the ego, that this is just as, you know, there is no such thing as being a martyr. This is just as egoistic as anything else, this sort of self-doubt. So I take no pride in it. And I'm just wondering if you have any sort of thoughts or comments. I know this is something you've spoken about us here, but I'd like to hear it differently now.
Let me see if I can get clear on what it is. Is it this setting up the ideal and beating yourself up for not filling it?
It's that, but it's also, I can think of, if you and I had a dispute of some sort, I could think of a million reasons to be compassionate about where you're coming from. But if I do something wrong, I will beat myself up for that forever and not have that same compassion.
Yeah. Yes. Have you done the Brahmavihara practices at all? Yeah. Well, there's a very curious thing with the Brahmavihara practices, which always strikes me as a bit of a surprise every time I begin them, which is you start with yourself. May I be happy, joyous, loving, peaceful. It's like, what? Me? Oh, it's okay to do this for me. Oh, well, how about that? So, you know, still there's this moment of surprise each time. So let's see. So how to work with this? Well, first off, let's acknowledge you are working with it because you're bringing awareness to it. And awareness, as you said, will eventually begin to undermine it. And there are practices which directly undermining of that kind of self-attack, self-doubt. And certainly the two practices of loving-kindness and compassion are very good for that. And, you know, so you might consider doing those. and just beginning them at whatever level and degree you wish, perhaps just a few recitations a day. May I be happy. My favorite phrase that I, you make up your own phrase for these. There are classic ones, but my one is, may I be happy, joyous, loving, peaceful. May all beings be happy, joyous, loving, peaceful. And you'd just repeat that as much as you wish. Or may I be free of pain and sorrow. May all beings be free of pain and sorrow. So those two, done over time, are a beautiful antidote to that kind of self-attack, self-judgment. So those are a couple of things that come to mind. Christopher, Daniel, do you have any others to recommend? Yeah, right. And their practices, they take time. Yeah.
I was so moved when you said that you can't, even the good things you do, when I do good things, I say, well, God did it, or my hands did it, I'm just a pair of hands, right? But when I do bad things, I take the thing, and of course, this is ridiculous, and you're the first person that I ever heard say that. And it's almost as though I feel like I've been tarred and feathered, and physically, doing winds and channels, we actually seem to have the stars and feathers between our baffles. And so I would do something, I might cough, and then, try to heal myself. And I would hear my mother say, sit down, shut up, or something like that. It would be all negative. And after a while, when I could release some of this from the channels, and it's actually some physical things, the sound went away. So it was just like an echo that wasn't mine. It was just like I had been taken over or tarred and feathered so I could never hear myself. Finally, I feel like I am who I am. I always cared about everybody. I couldn't understand why people couldn't care. So I'm glad to be who I am now, but it was a lot of work, and thank you.
Well, thank you for your work. Maybe Drew is doing some de-tarring and de-feathering in the morning, so... Yeah, last one. Yeah.
I just so relate to what you said. I'm so good at beating myself up. And there's one Mother Teresa phrase that has just sort of calmed me down every time I hear it in my head. And that is, she says, yes, you're supposed to help people. And it's usually best just to start with the person next to you. And so I don't get so overwhelmed with thinking I really have to save the world today before I go to bed. And the other thing that has been quite humbling is working in a nonprofit that you may relate to is I often think about Lucy and Ethel in the chocolate factory. And when they are going through and the line speeds up and they're supposed to be wrapping these little chocolates and wrapping the chocolates and wrapping the chocolates. And they eventually get to the point where they're stuffing the chocolates in their mouth and it's not a pretty picture. And when I tried to take my corporate self into the nonprofit world, I found myself, stuffing a lot of chocolates in my mouth trying to get everything done. And so we have this little saying at the church, it seems to have calmed me down as well. And I say, sometimes there's going to be chocolates that are going to fall on the floor, and we're just going to wrap as many as we can, and that's going to be okay. So thank you, Lucille Ball.
And thank you, Janet. I had a bad case of the I should have said 2 days ago after Janet's wonderful talk, when I realized she gave such a beautiful example of what I was talking about the way teachers will use their mistakes for the benefit and teaching of others. It was just a very touching and beautiful example, so thank you. So we have taken this bodhisattvic aspiration, so let's repeat it on page 23. In English, now and for the rest of our lives, as a joyful expression of who we are, and what we really want. May the pure, brilliant sun of bodhicitta dawn in each and every heart and mind, dispelling the darkness of suffering and confusion unstoppably until all are illumined and awakened.